about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Joe Jackson, and he'll be answering your questions on do-it-yourself fly fishing in Alaska. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share a podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Joe Jackson about DIY fly fishing Alaska. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Joe, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, if you do so now, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says register for the free drawing. Click on the link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Joe's book, It's Only Fishing, courtesy of Epicenter Press. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Joe and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, take some notes, and maybe you'll be the proud winner of Joe's book, It's Only Fly Fishing. Our guest tonight is Joe Jackson. Joe is a social studies teacher and outdoor writer in Alaska. His work has appeared in many publications such as Gray's Sporting Journal, Fly Fisherman, The Drake, Alaska Magazine, and others, where his wife, Emmy, also publishes much of her photography. He has written two books of outdoor essays, It's Only Fly Fishing and Chasing the Dark. When he's not out getting up early to chase rainbow trout or hunting ptarmigan, he's learning how to be a father to the world's next greatest fly fisher woman. Joe, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks a lot for having me, Roger. I'm excited to talk DIY fly fishing in Alaska, one of my favorite subjects, if not my favorite subject.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Yeah. So good. Well, good to have you. We got lots of questions to go through. It's kind of a interesting topic, and like you and I were talking before the show, I mean, Alaska is huge. So
it
when you
huge.
Say good. Do-it-yourself fly fishing in Alaska is like saying do-it-yourself fly fishing on the eastern coast of the United States or something, you know. It's just a massive area to cover. But anyway, you're going to make it all simple for us tonight, I'm sure.
So. I'll try.
Okay. Well, what inspired me to start exploring Alaska's fisheries without a guide?
Yeah, so for me it was pretty simple. It was money or a lack thereof. I was a poor college student. That was kind of the reason I came up here, was to go to college in Fairbanks, and I brought a love of fishing with me and didn't have any money to get a guide, and so my only option was kind of to do it myself and figure it out. And through that, you know, I found out that it's a lot more rewarding, at least to me, to be able to, you know, really crack a fishery, start off not knowing anything about it, But then, you know, slowly through your observation and pattern recognition and lots of early mornings and many miles hiked, you know, you can slowly start to get acquainted with a place, and not just the fish, you know, the environment too, the birds and the wildlife and the seasons. It's really cool to be able to do that. So that's kind of what's kept me on the DIY tack now that I'm not quite as poor as I was when I was a college student. But yeah, the reward of it is what keeps me doing it myself now.
There's only two seasons up there, right? Winter and almost exactly. Summer.
Well, yeah, we say winter and road construction. That's
winter and road construction. Yeah, with the heaving of the roads. I remember that. Were you fly fishing before you moved to Alaska?
A little bit, yeah. So I grew up in Wyoming, and I feel like Wyoming's another place. If you grow up there, it's kind of inevitable you're going to pick up fly fishing in some capacity. So I wasn't super intense with fly fishing before coming to Alaska, but yeah, Alaska definitely grew that in me.
Good, good. Phil McCartney in Kentucky wrote in, he says, please tell us about your first fishing trip to Alaska and the progression of your DIY knowledge. Have there been hard lessons along the way? He says, when I was 20, I thought getting to Alaska would be the only thing between me and plenty of fish. In the many years since then, I've learned that preparation matters. Yeah.
Well, that is a great question, Phil. And yeah, I've definitely encountered some hard lessons, learned some hard lessons along the way. My first real fishing trip to Alaska, I guess that kind of changed the way I thought about fishing, was with a really good friend of mine. His name's Ryan. And funnily enough, we grew up in the same spot of Wyoming and ended up in Fairbanks, Alaska, independently of one another. But he invited me trout fishing at a spot along the Parks Highway, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a little bit. And I went with him, and, you know, I wasn't super into fly fishing just yet, but with him, you know, we drove down, and from Fairbanks, it's about 4 hours. So I think we got to our chosen campground at like 11 o'clock at night or something. And he's like, all right, let's go fishing. And so we went out, and we were fishing till 1 or 2 a.m. trying to catch a coho salmon, and then pitched a tent and slept in the rain for, you know, 2 hours, and got up at 4 o'clock to hike a few miles in the dark and make sure we were the first ones on this little trout stream on the Parks Highway. And at the time, I was not super into it, right? Like 2 hours of sleep, tromping through the rain. I thought this guy was crazy. But I realized after the day of fishing that we had and the immense trout we were pulling out of this stream and just the incredible experience it was, that you kind of get out of it what you put into it. And ever since then, that's kind of how I've operated. You know, if you want to have a really cool experience, you have to put in the time and the effort and the early mornings or the late nights, whatever the case is, and put up with whatever weather you have to. So those are hard lessons to learn kind of as a newbie, you know, and they're hard lessons to learn continually. I don't think I ever want to crawl out of a warm sleeping bag at 4 a.m. when it's 35 right. degrees outside to go try and catch a steelhead.
Exactly.
But I do it because I know what potential rewards could be.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because when you do go through that extra effort, the rewards are sometimes not what at all that you were hoping for. And it might
exactly.
be you get to see a moose on the trail end or a bear or, you know, something in nature, a beautiful sunrise or, you know, I mean, there's all those
exactly.
other things in nature that you get to enjoy because you got up early and you put the extra effort in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say Alaska's got lots of consolation prizes. So
that's
one of the reasons I love it.
Yeah. Now, how do you define do-it-yourself fly fishing in the Alaskan context?
Yeah, so it's really, to me, it's deciding kind of where to go, when, and how you're best going to fish it, but then also having, you know, this exploration mindset, like you don't quite know what you're going to find, but you're interested in what's out there. So that, to me, is kind of the do-it-yourself mindset, especially in such a vast place as Alaska. You know, you compared it to DIYing the eastern United States or, you know, like maybe the entire Mountain West or something. Yeah, it's just a huge area, but being a do-it-yourselfer is being willing to sort of crack the code of different fisheries along the way.
When you say do-it-yourself, would you include, I mean, obviously it's driving, walking, hiking, backpacking. Does it include river running, you know, doing river trips on your own and those kind of things as well?
Yeah, totally. And yeah, I mean, even if you do fly out, but you're the one running the show and figuring out logistics and stuff, I would still put that in the DIY categories.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about fly fishing in Alaska on their own?
Yeah, it's funny, Roger. I feel like there's two distinct camps about fly fishing in Alaska on a person's own. There's either the it's so easy camp, right? I mean, if you Google Alaskan fishing, right, you're going to be met with hundreds of photos of gigantic king salmon and fat rainbow trout and Dolly Varden and all that. And the people that think it's easy. And in fact, there's a quote that I've heard that there are no good anglers in Alaska. There's only good fishing. So that's camp one. And then camp two is if you're going to do it from the road system, it's really difficult to do. What you have to do is fly out to these lodges in the remote areas if you want to get that good fishing. And I don't really agree with either camp. I feel like it's possible to sort of balance between the two. It can be really easy to fish in Alaska. There is a lot of good fishing, but you have to know how to effectively target that good fishing, and you have to know when to be there and how to capitalize on that. And yeah, by the same token, you can have amazing experiences on the road system, you know, as amazing as you might have in a remote flyout trip, if you're willing to put in some extra work. So yeah, the misconceptions that it's either too easy or impossible on the road system, those are probably the big ones.
Yeah. And things have changed a lot. Like, again, before the show started, we were talking, you know, I grew up in Alaska in the 60s, and it was easy back then.
Yeah.
It was, but, you know, we drove up on the Alcan Highway, and it was gravel, dirt road, you know. Now it's paved.
Yeah.
That prevented a lot of people from getting to Alaska.
Exactly,
And I know you, living in southern Anchorage, know where Bird Creek is. And,
oh, yeah.
My dad and I used to go down there. We'd be the only two people fishing that stretch of the water from the inlet, you know, on up. And I remember complaining to my dad about catching too many fish and my arms were sore. I mean, literally. I mean, it's no joke.
Yeah.
And, of course, we were keeping those salmon and taking them back and smoking them and eating them. But
sure.
But anyway, it was – but then what was it? It's probably been let's see, almost 30 years ago I was up there, and we had a layover in Alaska. We did a fly-in trip, went down to Bird Creek, and it was shoulder to shoulder. And, oh my gosh, this has changed so incredibly, you know, since I was a kid up there. And so I know that that's the same thing down here in the, you know, in the lower 48, is that you've got limited water. We're not getting any more water. And, but there's more people fishing. Population's grown.
Exactly.
And, but like you say, too, it's like down here, you know, if you're willing to walk a half a mile, you'll get away from most of the people. So
that's, it's funny how that works.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. It's like you look at a lot of the really pressured fisheries in around Anchorage or even on the Kenai Peninsula, you can follow the well-beaten footpath, you know, 100 yards downstream, but if you're willing to go past that, you know, 90% of anglers, they see the end of the trail and they're like, okay, I'm going to fish here or whatever. I'm not going to go any further. If you do go farther, chances are you can have some solitude, but a lot more than you'd get going where everybody else does.
Right, right. Well, what are the most important factors to consider when planning a do-it-yourself trip? I know some people go up there with just that intent, you know, that they're going to maybe even drive up the Alcan Highway and not ever hire a guide, or maybe hire a guide for a day or something like that and do the rest on their own.
Yeah. And that's whenever people ask me that, and that is a common question, you know, what do I need to do to come fishing in Alaska? And my first question in response is, well, what type of an experience do you want? Because with Pacific salmon kind of dominating the fisheries in most of Alaska, not all, but most of them, it really is timing dependent. So if you want to come to Alaska and go home with your cooler full of salmon, you're looking at, you know, June through August when the salmon are running. Kings are first in early June across the state, and then followed by sockeyes followed by Pinks and Chums, and then finally the Cohos in August and September. So that's kind of the first question to ask yourself. Do I want to fish for salmon? Do I want to fish for trout, grayling, or do I want to kind of have a mix of everything? Because if you want that, then you're looking at like a July or late June, July, August sort of time frame. But if you're looking for like steelhead, then that's going to be a spring or a fall type of deal. Yeah, the biggest one is timing, and then once you figure out the timing, then you can start figuring out, okay, car rental, you know, as that applies, flights, camping, whatever else you need to figure out.
Yeah, you know, being that there was Alaska so much to offer in the way of fishing, it's kind of hard to decide what you want to do,
yep.
You know. And then nature doesn't always cooperate with timing.
Yep.
I mean, we found that out on a fly-in trip that we went to the Togiak River in Bristol Bay, and we were trying to time it for cohos or silvers, and they were coming in late. But you know what? We had just a great time fishing for chum salmon, which a lot of people don't know about. I mean, we were catching them on nymphs, and we had a fantastic time fishing for Dolly Varden. So, and char. So it still was a great trip, but it wasn't, we didn't nail the timing on the silvers weren't cooperating as well as we had hoped. And that's always something I guess you have to contend with in Alaska.
It is. Well, that's something I sympathize with, you know, people that don't live here year round, right? I mean, I have a hard enough time trying to time things correctly, and I live here. I can't imagine, looking at your summer 3-4 months in advance and trying to nail down a time because, salmon runs, you know, you try and hit the peak of a salmon run, say, on the Russian River, and it'll vary slightly every year. And then if you get a big dump of rain, that might push more fish in, push fish out. It all depends on kind of what's going on. And, of course, we have no control over that. I guess with the logistics piece, you kind of mentioned you didn't get the cohos that you were hoping for, but you did find some of those consolation prizes in chums and Dolly Varden and Arctic char. Yeah, I would say anybody that's wanting to do a DIY trip to Alaska, be prepared to find those consolation prizes, because if they don't exactly the way that you want them to, you shouldn't let that be a disappointment. Yeah, look for other things that are cool about your experience, because I can guarantee there's going to be plenty.
Yeah, I mean, on that trip, we caught silvers, we caught Dolly Varden, we caught char, and we caught grayling. I mean, we caught four different fish, and I mean, I think that's a pretty good week, regardless, you know.
Yep.
So we were not complaining. Let's take a quick break here, Joe, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about planning and logistics and dig deeper into do-it-yourself fly fishing in Alaska.
Sounds good.
The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Joe Jackson about do-it-yourself fly fishing in Alaska. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer them on the show tonight. And let's just see here. Oh, your wife's excited to listen to you, Joe.
Oh,
you wrote in.
That's nice of her.
Oh, yeah, that's nice of her. Okay. So I always ask my guests, you know, at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us a bit about how you're connected and what you're up to.
Yeah, so our fishing season is kind of just starting up in Alaska here, and that usually always means steelhead for me. If I'm lucky enough to have a trip planned to southeast, then I'll be doing that, but with a year and a half old daughter, that's a little more challenging these days. So I took my first trip 2 weekends ago down to the Kenai Peninsula for steelhead, and I was lucky enough to get my very first steelhead on a spey rod, so that was pretty awesome for me.
Cool.
Great way to start the season off. But yeah, from there, I'll start transitioning into king salmon mode, and king salmon, we'll see how their numbers are doing. Unfortunately, they're not doing so hot statewide right now. Since 2007, kings have been declining kind of across their range in Alaska. But there is one fishery I target on the Kenai Peninsula where there's a hatchery supplement, and provided that fishery stays open, I always love practicing my bait casting down there. We'll see how that goes. And then from there, it's trout and grayling and more salmon until fall shows up and then inevitable winter. So that's kind of what my season looks like. And then as a writer as well, it always involves looking for new writing materials. You mentioned in the intro that I've got my two books out, It's Only Fishing and Chasing the Dark, and I'm working on a third. I don't know when that's going to be done, but yeah, just trying to amass more of that currently.
Yeah, well, again, you've done a lot of writing in the magazines, as we talked about in your intro.
Magazine articles here and there as I think of ideas, and people like those ideas. So
yeah. Now, do you have a website that you can share with people so they can get in contact with you or whatever?
So, my website is josephdjacksonwriter.com. I tried to get a shorter one, but somebody nabbed the domain name. Josephdjacksonwriter.com, and you can get updates on my books. You can buy signed copies when I have them in stock, which I currently do. Yeah, and you can reach out to me there as well if you want.
Okay, great, great, terrific. All right, well, thanks for sharing all that with us, and let's dive back in. What are the pros and cons of fly fishing, you know, do-it-yourself versus hiring a guide in Alaska?
So pros, obviously, it shortens the learning curve. You'll get on fish probably much quicker than you would otherwise. And for, you know, rivers like the Kenai, I'll use that as an example, that can be a very difficult river to fish as a DIYer just because of how big it is and how much information is out there. So a guide, not only are they going to have a boat and know all the holes on the Kenai to take you on, but they're going to have a good sense of what information you actually need to know and what information you don't, because I find that it's very easy to get overwhelmed with the amount of information out there about fishing in Alaska. So a guide's going to help you weed through that, I guess. And also, they just know cool stuff about the area usually, so, you know, they'll be able to tell you the natural history of where you're at, maybe some of its history. And it's cool to just be fishing with kindred spirits, you know, other people that love fly fishing. Those are definitely the pros. Cons, it can be expensive. You know, Alaska, well, remote Alaska, I guess, in particular, Bristol Bay and all that, that's one of the most expensive places to fish anywhere in the world. And so the expense is one thing, but yeah. And then cons, in addition to that, I guess, are, yeah, I can't think of any off the top of my head besides money, but a lot of people might want to do like a some guided and then some DIY. You kind of mentioned that earlier.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe do a day with a guide and then you can kind of learn the ropes and figure it out. That can be a really good way to do it. In fact, the friend I mentioned in a story a while ago, he did that on one of the streams on the Parks Highway just because he was trying to figure it out and couldn't. So he hired a guide for a day, and it really showed him the light, so to speak. And that was really useful. That's another, we'll add that to the pro column.
Yeah, and that's true anywhere in the world.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I do that many times myself. Yeah. And one note that we found out is when we did do our fly-in trip to Bristol Bay is, you know, you got to shop around. There are the ultra deluxe lodges with the hot tub and the professional chef and the massages and, you know, and you're going to pay for that. But we did it was fun. I mean, it was kind of these, I would call it a tent camp on an island. It was these little Quonset kind of tents, you know, two to a tent. And you're sleeping on cots, and they had a dining hall, you know. But it was pretty much like camping, but you're taken care of. But there was they had a rudimentary sauna that they had built. But, I mean, it was nice, but not luxury by any means. But, you know, it saved us probably about $5,000 each. So that's why I say you got to shop around a bit.
Exactly.
And there are less expensive fly-in places, but
right.
Yeah. And it's also like they have the airplane fuel and stuff like that. I mean, it's kind of like fishing the saltwater too nowadays, where the cost of fuel is high. I mean, these
Oh
poor
yeah.
guides are having to foot the bill for the cost of the fuel,
Yep.
and it's a lot different than riding a drift boat down the river, you know.
Oh,
So,
exactly. Yeah.
yeah. Well, now, how do you research and locate productive roadside accessible fishing areas?
So a lot of the typical internet tools are pretty useful to me, you know, Google Earth and Onyx. Those are great for seeing satellite views of things. They can be deceptive, as I'm sure a lot of listeners know. You know, you might look at something on Google Earth and be like, ah, it wouldn't be that much effort to get to. And then you get on the ground and you try and get to it, and it's like a mile of a wickerwork of alders that you have to tromp through. And that's definitely happened to me. It's like, okay, this isn't going to work. But those two things are good for getting a view of things. And some of the satellite imagery now is high enough resolution where you can pick out possible good fishing locations like bends and cut banks and riffles and all that. That's useful as a starting point, but obviously getting boots on the ground if you can, and scouting, or better yet, scouting and fishing at the same time. So that's really useful. There is one book that I want to plug that's kind of the Bible of do-it-yourself Alaskan anglers, and it's called The Highway Angler by Gunnar Peterson. That's a book that I carry in my truck. In fact, I think I have multiple copies of it, and anytime I drive by a stream that I am intrigued by, I'll look it up in Highway Angler, and it doesn't have everything marked, but it has a lot of them, and it usually gives a pretty good indication of what you can expect to be there. Definitely, if you're doing a DIY trip to Alaska on the road system, I would encourage listeners to get a copy of that, The Highway Angler by Gunnar Peterson. So those are probably my big ones. Satellite imagery, your waders and a pair of boots, and then, yeah, Highway Angler.
Kind of like the tools for blue lining kind of situation.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yep.
Now, what's the accessibility as far as private versus public water? Is that an issue, and how do you know? Does the Gunner book spell that out, or is there another source?
Yeah, no, great question. The Highway Angler, points out all points of access for streams, which is really nice. You know, if the road crosses a stream, it'll tell you exactly where, but if there are other access points downstream or upstream of the bridge, it'll tell you that. And Alaska's, we're really lucky in the state to have stream bed laws that allow you to be in the stream bed provided you're below high water mark. And so a lot of fisheries you can access just by parking at the bridge, provided you can get off the road, but then hiking up or downstream. And yeah, provided you don't go above high water mark onto possibly adjacent private land, you're all good there. But then on top of that, Alaska's got tons of public land, whether it's BLM or state land, that you can get out and tromp around on. We're pretty lucky to have all that.
Yeah. Can you kind of walk us through some of the best regions in Alaska for road accessible fishing?
Yeah. So there's kind of the two big categories. You've got like interior Alaska and then, well, three categories. Interior Alaska, South Central, and the Kenai Peninsula. And with interior, you're looking at anything north of the Alaska Range. So the mountain range that Denali is a part of, pretty much anything north of that is considered interior Alaska. And that's going to involve a lot of grayling fishing. That's kind of grayling heaven in my mind. So there's that. And then South Central, that's like Palmer, Wasilla, most of the Parks Highway, and then like the Glen Highway and some of the Richardson. And that's going to have a pretty good variety of species. You're going to have some grayling here and there, really good trout fishing, particularly along the Parks Highway, and then some salmon offerings depending on where you're at, again, mostly on the Parks Highway. And then finally, the Kenai Peninsula, which is probably the most well-known and heavily fished. It's in close proximity to Anchorage, 2 hours down, and you're on the Kenai. But that's got the world-class salmon fishing in the Kenai River, and then, of course, huge rainbow trout, Ballybarden, and in the fall, mostly steelheads. That's kind of the flyby of the big three road-accessible regions.
And in southeastern Alaska is, I suppose, the road access is very limited because you have to get there by boat or plane in the first place, right?
Right. Yeah, that's a good
And
point, Roger. Southeast. I kind of, as a road accessible angler, I oftentimes forget about that. But yeah, definitely you've got parts of Southeast that once you're there, you can, you've got a little bit of road to get around on. Places like Yakutat and Juneau and Sitka, those are probably the most popular destinations for Southeast Alaskan fishing. And Ketchikan too, of course.
You had just mentioned, kind of the major differences, I think, between the Kenai and interior.
Yep.
Where does, when we talk about interior, where does the kind of salmon fishing stop? In other words,
Oh
where are
yeah.
you, at what point do you're just focused on pretty much rainbows and grayling, like you had mentioned?
Yeah, great question. So the Parks Highway, probably up until about mile 140 or so, I would say, is where the salmon fishing kind of stops. There are some king salmon runs that go even farther north than that, almost all the way up into the Alaska Range, but those have been closed for the last several years, and I would guess they will be closed or should be closed for the foreseeable future. But yeah, I'd say up until mile 130, 140, that's where the salmon fishing kind of in from there to where the Alaska Range mountains start. That's trout and grayling. And then north of the Alaska Range, it's interesting because there's no known indigenous populations of rainbow trout. Once you get through the Alaska Range, the trout stop and the grayling really start.
And at a certain point, you run into some pike up there too, don't you?
Yeah,
Or is that not?
you can get pike in interior. They are in South Central, but they're kind of public enemy number one. They love to eat salmon smolt, and so yeah, they're pike fishing is not great in South Central just because any that are caught are mostly killed. And so interior is probably better for that. And for pike, you're looking at like the Yukon River drainage or Minto Flats nearish to Fairbanks.
Right. Now, when you say, you keep saying the Parks Highway, so the Parks Highway is the highway that goes through Denali, right? National Park.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It
Yeah.
connects Anchorage to Fairbanks. I think it's about 340, maybe 350 miles long. And yeah, it cuts right through the Alaska Range and, of course, Denali National Park. If you go there, you have to get there from the Parks Highway.
And is there fishing all along that highway? I mean, is the
Yeah, the quality will vary a lot. I would say the meat of the good fishing is between mile 60 and 130, so just north of like Wasilla in the Willow area, and then up to Talkeetna and Trapper Creek. That's kind of the meat of where the most productive fishing is and where most of the fishing pressure happens. But farther north from that, you want a small stream experience with probably total solitude. I don't think you're going to see anybody else up there near like Cantwell, for example, but that would be mostly all grayling fishing.
Okay.
And grayling are an overlooked fish, I feel like, in Alaska. When you've got the possibility of 30-inch rainbows, who would want to catch a 14-inch grayling? But I love grayling. I love the fishing experience that they offer. And yes, those smaller streams north on the Parks Highway, I would not shy away from it. If you're a fly fishing purist and like catching fish on dry flies, that could be a pretty fun way
Oh
to
yeah.
spend time.
Yeah, I was thrilled when I caught my first grayling up there because
Yep.
it was I wasn't expecting it, number one. I wasn't fishing for grayling,
Yep.
and there she was, and I was like, this is wonderful. I think going
Yeah,
like 18
they're
inch
amazing
grayling.
fish.
They're so beautiful. So yeah, you already talked about what we could target along the Parks Highway. Let me see here. What's the fly fishing scene look like around Fairbanks?
Yeah, that's another good question, and one that is near and dear to me because that's kind of my first experiences in
Right.
Alaska were around Fairbanks. So a lot of grayling fishing, historically salmon fishing as well, because king, chum, and coho salmon, run 900 plus river miles up the Yukon and then up the Tanana to the Fairbanks area. But again, that fishery's been closed for a while now and probably will be. But yeah, grayling. especially along like the Chena Hot Springs Road. The Chena River is world class for grayling, in my opinion, if you know where to go and how to fish it. And that's kind of a DIYer's dream, honestly, the Chena, because you can drive up Chena Hot Springs Road. There are a lot of campsites along that road, and it's a very wadeable, hikeable river, so you can kind of get out and wander to your heart's content and fly fish for grayling in a really beautiful place. So that's a cool one. And then there are opportunities for some Dolly Varden. They're going to be smaller fish in interior, but they can still be fun. And then, of course, the pike I mentioned before. And then down by Delta, one of the best grayling fisheries in the world, probably, right there in Delta, the Delta Clearwater. That was always one of my favorite haunts. And even now, despite being, you know, 6-7 hours away, I still try and make a point to get up to the Delta Clearwater every summer, because the grayling in there are huge and abundant, and there are even mayfly hatches that go off like clockwork there in the summertime. So if you miss fishing true insect imitations in Alaska, which aren't super common, that can be a really good way to get some fly fishing in.
Yeah. Now, so when we talked about the areas, the interior, South Central, Kenai, the South Central is, again, can you describe what that area is to you?
Yeah, so that's kind of everything north of Anchorage, but south of the Alaska Range. Kind of the mountains are always the boundaries of how we end things, at least in terms of fishing areas. So north of Anchorage, south of the Alaska Range, and that would include that Parks Highway that we talked about. But it would also include, because the Parks goes like northwest out of Anchorage and up to Fairbanks, but then the other direction, northeast-ish, is the Glen Highway. There's not a ton of fishing along the Glen Highway. There is a smattering of some stocked lakes, but I'm assuming if you come to Alaska for fishing, you're not doing it to catch stocked rainbow trout. So, but not when there's beautiful wild leopard-spotted rainbow trout to catch elsewhere, you know. But the Glen goes out east and meets the Richardson at a little town called Glen Allen. And actually, my wife's family is from that area. It's called the Copper River Valley. There's some pretty amazing fishing around there for the world-famous Copper River salmon, which I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard of. That's the very same Copper River that Copper River salmon run up to spawn every summer. That's a pretty good spot for fishing opportunities. For salmon, of course, mostly sockeyes, but then grayling as well. And then the Golcana River, which flows into the Copper, that is the northernmost habitat for wild rainbow trout in the world, I think. There might be a population in Russia that's just slightly north, but as far as biologists know, the Golcana River is the northernmost rainbow trout populations. That can be a pretty cool experience, too.
Now, are those rivers in that area coming up from down there by Cordova kind of area? Is that where?
That's where the Copper dumps out at. Exactly, yeah.
Cordova.
And then you have feeders like the Golcana and the Cleetent that feed into that up in the Glen Allen area. Yeah, and then the headwaters of the Golcana are up in the Alaska Range, which again is our boundary to where you have the interior Alaska north of
that. So, but there's no roads down in the Cordova area, right?
You'd have to, if you wanted to get to Cordova, you'd have to fly. There's a short section of road or a small road system, I should say, in Cordova, but yeah, limited.
Well, that's one thing we really haven't, we'll talk about this after the break, but I want to talk about off the main highways, because we've been talking the main highways, but there's more to it than that. So hang tight, and we'll be back in just a minute. Discover the power of pure skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steel head flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Joe Jackson about do-it-yourself fly fishing in Alaska. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Let me just check in on that here. Oh, okay. Abel, we got your question, but that's Wyoming. We're not talking about Wyoming today. It was a question about what's your favorite fishing hole in Wyoming. But, yeah, we got too much to talk about in Alaska.
Yeah.
So, yes. Now, that's why it was kind of, you know, I'm looking at the map here of Alaska as we're talking, and I see that there is what appears to be from Copper Center south a road.
Yep.
That goes down to Wortmans or somewhere down
there.
Oh,
yeah, and then down to Valdez. Yeah, that's the Richardson Highway. And there is some fishing for Dolly Varden down by Valdez on the southern part of on the Richardson. But, yeah, Copper Center that you just described, that's kind of where the meat of the salmon fishing really happens.
It happens up there, yeah. But down the Copper River to the ocean, there's just nothing, no accessibility there except by boat, I think.
Yeah, it can be tough to access. I know there's obviously a lot of angling effort done by Cordova for cohos, and I mean, that's where the commercial fishery for the Copper River operates, is off of Cordova. But then around the Chitna area, where the Chitna River and Copper Rivers meet, I'm sure you've heard of, well, you probably know all about dip netting, but for listeners that don't, that's literally where you have a dip net and you can get subsistence permits to harvest lots and lots of salmon. It's the most effective way to catch salmon without being a fisherman, you know.
Right.
That's where a lot of angling effort happens, but I know not fly fishing.
And what about all the, how much accessibility is there through side roads, dirt roads that are off the main highways we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, quite a bit there. You just have to be cognizant of public versus private. That's where an app like Onyx comes in super handy, because you can see what's state land and what's not. But usually it'll be posted, you know, if it's land belonging to a native corporation, they'll post that it's private. You can't access it without a permit to access native lands, which you can buy. But otherwise, yeah, sometimes it's, you look at the satellite maps, like I mentioned earlier, and you see a road and you go out and check it out. If it's private, it's private. If not, you can poke around and see what it looks like.
Yeah, good. Okay.
I guess that I just thought of a point we should probably talk about, Roger, and that's
sure.
like vehicle rentals, right? Like if you don't want to just be driving down some random potholed road in a Camry that you rent in Anchorage, you know. That's something that people will want to consider, is a lot of the side roads that you kind of need to get on to get off the beaten path are going to require 4x4 vehicles, but you can definitely rent. And there are some companies based in Anchorage I know of that kind of specialize in those go-anywhere adventure-type vehicles. But then depending on where you want to go in the state, some rental companies have restrictions. For example, you can't drive on the Denali Highway or the Taylor Highway or the Dalton Highway through certain rental agencies. So that's just something to be aware of. I would recommend getting a 4x4 whenever possible in Alaska.
Okay. Good. Good advice. So what species are most available to do-it-yourself fly fishers throughout the year? I mean, if...
I would say probably trout and grayling are kind of king as far as that goes, because you could, I mean, theoretically, you could catch them all the way from April to October if conditions allow for it. Salmon, obviously, they're a limited time frame, but they are very abundant typically, especially if we're talking something like sockeye salmon. And so it's a flurry of activity for, you know, a month or two, and then it'll end. But, yeah, as far as longest seasons, I guess, or longest availability, it'd have to be trout and grayling.
Now, the salmon, you know, I'm just envisioning how large Alaska is and all these different river systems. There's got to be a difference in timing based upon what river you, I mean, the Kenai, for instance, versus over there on Copper,
Exactly,
the
yeah.
Copper River. So is there a way to figure that out? In other words, you're too early in the Kenai, but if you're willing to drive over, you know, the Copper, you might have some luck with a particular species?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, obviously proximity to the ocean is going to affect, you know, how long it takes salmon to get somewhere. Like the Kenai, you know, they're, once fish leave the ocean and they're in the Kenai, I mean, you could target them within a week, you know, in the Little Kenai. A river like the Russian that flows into the Kenai, usually the peak of the sockeye run, for example, is like the second or third week of June, at least for the first run. And then there'll be another run in like July and August. But in Copper Center, those fish getting up the Copper, they have to go a lot farther in river miles. And so physically, it's going to take them longer to get there. So that's more of like a third week of June, first week of July type of thing. The wonderful thing about Alaska and our Department of Fish and Game is that most all of the popular fisheries, at least for salmon, have counting stations, whether it's a sonar counter or somebody sitting in the stand and literally counting each and every salmon that goes past. The data is there for the public to look at. So you can go on Fish and Game's website and you can look at past years, you know, like last year, if you want to see when the peak of the Kenai sockeye run was, you could go and look at the data and see when that was. And I guess that, that would be a tool I would add to kind of my recommended tools list for anybody wanting to come up here, is check out the data from fish counts on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website, because it can shed some good light on when typically runs will peak and kind of when you can expect maybe to peak this year. I know I watch it like a hawk, especially the Copper River sonar counts. When those start coming in, usually towards the end of this month, I'll start watching and trying to guess when I think the fishing is going to be best.
What kind of salmon run up the Copper?
They get sockeyes and kings, but the king's another one where it's probably going to be closed, and for good reasons.
Yeah.
Mostly sockeyes.
Yeah, we did a show on sockeyes, I believe, a while back, and I found it interesting. Most fly fishers don't think of sockeyes as a fish to target. And one thing I learned, and I didn't know, I caught a sockeye. Oh, that was another fish I caught that trip was a sockeye.
So, okay.
But, yeah, is that they're vegetarians and that they really aren't on the hunt for any kind of other fish or invertebrates or things like that. And so now, how do you fish for the sockeye? I mean, what's the best approach
great
you use?
And that's always a debate in angling circles in Alaska. Sockeyes don't take flies, you know, people say that, but I believe
they
do occasionally.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the dominant technique is something called flossing, where literally you're trying to snag them in the mouth. It's not glamorous, but it can be effective. But I've had experiences where I've watched sockeyes leave their jag of fish and chase down my fly. So it does happen, you know. I feel they're like anything. If you irritate them enough, you can incite a reaction. It's just got to be the right fish at the right time, I suppose.
Yeah,
flossing is the dominant technique, like I said, and that's, just having usually an unweighted, slightly buoyant fly with a weight about 30, 36 inches up from the fly, and then you're, you know, making repeated flips. They're not even cast. You're just flipping line upstream at a 45-degree angle, and then you're ticking that weight along the bottom downstream about a 45-degree angle and hoping that your hook intercepts a fish's mouth.
Is that legal still?
Yes, it's defined by where the hook penetrates the mouth. So if it pokes them on the inside of the mouth, that's a legal fish. If it pokes them anywhere else, it's got to be released. So as you can imagine, that leads to a lot of snagging, which I've seen people keep fish that they shouldn't have. For the most part, I think people are good about following the law and returning fish that are caught that way. It's easier on a clear water system like the Russian River, where you can actually see fish. conditions are right, because then you know what you're casting to. Mm. On a river like the Clutina, for example, which is a tributary of the Copper, I mean, that's like fishing in a protein shake. You know, it's totally opaque. Yeah. You're not going to see anything, and you're literally just hoping that you're going to hook a fish. Surprisingly, it works out quite often.
Oh, yeah. When I was growing up there, it was legal to snag. And I remember using these lures. They were like about 5 inches long, this sleek, reflective heavy metal called a Lujon, I think they were called, if I remember. Lujon. And yeah, you just cast with a spinning rod and then, you know, reel it in and jerk, reel it in, jerk, reel it in, jerk, until you snagged one. And that was what a lot of people did back then. So
I know that's the thing to do. Yeah. Down by Seward, they still have, I'm sure elsewhere too, but Seward's the big one I know about, snagging season where, you know, people go down and they're fishing in the salt for these fish, but you're casting out a gigantic treble hook with a hunk of lead in the middle and just throwing it out, jerking it back.
So, yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Be a little, little heavy for a fly rod, but.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Forget it. So what do you recommend for gear? You know, on a you could be fishing for anything from kings to grayling, right? So what do you suggest people bring for the weight rods and so forth?
Yeah, so I've read a lot of articles and I've heard people try and find, like, if you had to bring one rod to Alaska, and it's like, I think you should totally ditch that argument. Do not only bring one rod to Alaska.
don't do it. Yeah.
No, as tempting as it might be, find the space, make the space, whatever you have to do to bring multiple rods. I'd say bring as many as you can, but at three, let's say three is our magic number. I would bring either a 4 or a 5 weight for grayling, and the shorter the rod, the easier it's going to be to get it into sort of tight, close quarters spaces, you know, the small stream experience I kind of talked about a little bit earlier. For bigger grayling, a 5 weight's going to be perfect. 4 weight, you might have a bit of a job getting them in, but 4 or 5 weight for grayling. I would say either a 6 or a 7 weight for trout. A 6 weight is what I throw religiously for trout. I started out with a 5 weight, and that proved to be enough for trout, so I'd go with a 6. And then for your salmon, probably an 8 weight. It's going to be light for kings, but because king opportunities are not super abundant right now, chances are you're probably not going to be fishing for kings, but yeah, an 8 weight's perfect for your cohos and your sockeyes, chums, pinks, if you're fishing for those guys.
You had mentioned earlier, you know, Alaska's not the place to go, basically, if you're looking for match-the-hatch kind of fishing.
Yeah.
So what must-have fly patterns you don't want to leave home without, what are those patterns that you want to have in Alaska?
Yeah, I did a magazine article, I think series, on that exact question, you know, what are the best flies for Alaska? Because, like I mentioned before, everything kind of hinges on the Pacific salmon run. Entire ecosystems hinge upon those fish showing up and dying and giving their nutrients to the system. That's really what fish are keying in on. But that said, they still do eat insects. They still eat smolt, fry, invertebrates, what have you. And so those flies, I wouldn't recommend you throw out the window before you come to Alaska, because I've caught a lot of fish on the Copper John. I love the Copper John. Okay. Even in Alaska. So that'd be my first pattern, the Copper John. I really love throwing wet flies, especially for grayling. I think that's one of the most fun ways to fish for grayling besides dry flies, but I'll talk about those in a second. So for wet flies, I really like the Partridge and Orange. It's just an old, simple, classic pattern. In fly tire, you can tie probably 20 in an hour and be equipped for some really awesome grayling fishing. As far as dry flies go, there's a fly called the Usual that was, I think it was developed in the Northeast, but sort of like a haystack pattern, and it's only tied using snowshoe hair, which is awesome because I also love to hunt snowshoe hares, but it's almost an unsinkable fly, and grayling and sometimes trout even love that dry fly. And then also humpies work really well, and mosquito patterns for dry flies. So Those are the insect-type flies I would recommend. And then if we're getting into the true Alaskan patterns, probably the most famous fly in Alaska is the Dalai Lama. And have you heard of the Dalai Lama, Roger?
Yes, I have. Yep.
Okay. And for listeners that have not heard of the Dalai Lama, it's probably the most awkward to cast fly you can imagine. It's two long strips of rabbit hide with an articulated hook and a great big cone head. So you can imagine when this thing gets soaked, it's like casting a dumbbell. But it works really, really well for trout and salmon. In fact, if I could only have one fly, I would probably throw a Dalai Lama because it's a fishy fly and it can target a lot of different species. There's that. Of course, the egg-sucking leech, that's another very versatile pattern. And then a little fly that I like, it's called the kiwi muddler. It's almost just like a cone-headed muddler minnow. But I really like the cone head because it makes it heavy and it'll get down into log jams or under cut banks, and it's a pretty fishy fly as well. Streamers, and then as far as salmon fly, a really good one is called the hairball leech, and it can be tied up in whatever color you want, but black is really a good versatile color for anything in Alaska. If you're fishing a black fly, whether it's an egg-sucking leech or a Dalai Lama or a hairball leech, I think you'd stand a pretty good chance against just about any fish in Alaskan stream.
Now, I know there's always the stories about, what is the egg-sucking leech? I tied a bunch of those before we went to Alaska, yep. But, you know, it doesn't really represent anything, right?
No. I did some exploring into this. Apparently it was developed, I want to say in the 80s, by a guide out in Bristol Bay. And I think there are conflicting accounts. One says that, you know, it was based on an observation of a leech that had attached itself to a salmon egg. But then other people say that's bogus and it's just more of like a general attractor. You know, the leech looks fishy, but then you've got the color that fish would associate with a salmon egg. I don't know, but it catches fish, that's for sure.
Yeah, the other fly that worked well for us up there was called an AP Black.
I've not heard of that one.
Yeah, I caught a lot of chum salmon on that.
Huh?
Yeah, just nymphing like you'd normally nymph, and then the chums
that's
would
cool.
take that. Yeah. So I don't know, back then we were told that was a fly to bring. I did, and it worked out really well. And now I still have a ton of them in my fly box that I hardly ever look at anymore. But, yeah, that was one that – and that's an old pattern. It's an old pattern. It's not anything new. Yeah.
We'll have to look that up. I don't think – nymphs don't get nearly enough credit, especially in Alaska. You know, I mentioned the Copper John earlier. People look at me – you know, people will ask me on the river, oh, what are you fishing with? It's the Copper John, and they'll look at you kind of funny. It's like, oh, that's not a bead or that's not a glow bug or whatever. And it's like,
right.
It works. So nymphs, that's a great tip. Nymphs work more often than you'd think in Alaska.
Let me take a quick break and then we'll finish up here talking about some camping and, you know, those kind of things as well up there. So I'll be back in just a few seconds.
Cool.
Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish, and to preserve and to protect and promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts wouldn't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Joe Jackson about do-it-yourself fly fishing Alaska. If you'd like to ask Joe a question, go ahead and fill that form out on our homepage, send it in, and we'll try to get it answered for you. Okay, Joe, Yeah, there was a question. I missed a couple that I wanted to do here. Chuck in Placerville, California said, what's the best time of year for somebody planning their trip, range of months that you can travel? He says, is it May through September?
Okay. Yeah, I guess it would be probably safely May through September. Yeah, that's the time question. It all depends on what you want. If you want access to a variety of species, you know, the salmon, trout, grayling, you're probably looking at July. Well, anywhere from late June to probably mid-August. So, you know, as your schedule would allow, anywhere in there would be a safe bet. If I had to pick personally, if I was coming up here and, you know, didn't live here year-round, I would probably want to come up in September, just because that's when the trout fishing is the best, and oftentimes the grayling fishing too. No, you're not going to have a shot at all the salmon, but you'll have a shot at some cohos, but then, you know, that's when the salmon are dying and the eggs are dropping and the trout and grayling are fat and eating, piling on for winters. It could be really fun.
Yeah, what's interesting is people don't really, you know how short the season is up there. I mean, I remember flying into Anchorage, and in the airport, they had a graph showing the traffic through the airport by months of the year.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I don't know if they still have that there or not. I mean, this is years and years ago. But it was very revealing. I mean, it went like, it was like almost flatlined during the winter, and then it jumped huge at the beginning of June for king season, you know, and then remained high all the way till September, then dropped like a rock again. You know, it was like this bell curve that was very distinct as to the traffic going through the airport. So that kind of tells you. But, yeah, a couple other questions. Jeff in New Mexico says, what's the best time for Dolly Varden, and what flies and techniques do you prefer? You've kind of hit on some of that already, but maybe you want to elaborate on that for him.
Yes, Dolly Varden, I'd say location-wise, you're probably looking at the Kenai Peninsula. There are a lot of streams, I mean, the Kenai included, but around the Kenai that flow into it, or even down by Seward that flow into the Resurrection River, have some pretty awesome dolly fishing. They can be caught throughout the summer, all the way May through September. I always like fishing for them in August, late August and September, just because that's when they're getting all colored up to spawn, and they're, in my opinion, the most beautiful fish when they're in their spawning colors. You know, just this emerald blue and like sunset colored spots, they're pretty incredible. Yeah, I'd say August, September, Kenai Peninsula, and flesh flies work really well for Dolly Varden at that time of year, as do, you know, the black egg sucking leech, or like a purple hairball leech, that can work pretty well too. And if you want a real adventure, Dolly Varden up on the Dalton Highway or on the North Slope in the Brooks Range, that would involve school planning, but those fish come from the Arctic Ocean and they can get huge. That would be a cool thing to explore if you were of the adventurous mindset.
Okay. Brent Setterfield in Dillon, Montana writes, I'm planning a trip to Alaska and large parts of it will be DIY. I'm curious as to why you don't often hear a lot about steelhead in Alaska. Any tips, info, or areas to have good DIY steelhead fishing would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, probably my very favorite fish, the steelhead. I know exactly why you don't often hear a lot. It's because the steelheaders that know it's quiet about it. And that's a thing. In fact, in my book, It's Only Fishing, my first one, there's a chapter about steelheading on the road system, and I think I say something like, you have to be wary of a steelheader that talks too much. And that's kind of the rule I've come to abide by, is keep your mouth shut, and if someone's talking too much, then they are probably lying to you. But yeah, steelhead are very accessible in Alaska. In the fall on the road system, you're looking at the Kenai Peninsula down by like Anchor Point, pretty much Anchor Point to Soldotna, all in that range. There are a series of rivers and streams that you can access steelhead on. And then if you're looking at southeast Alaska, which is really the king of steelheading in Alaska, you know, you're looking at Yakutat or Sitka, and that's going to be in the springtime, like mid to late April, early May, something like that.
Okay. But yeah, it's still let's see. Where's Sitka? Sitka is on the
Sitka is, it's on the panhandle. It's between like Ketchikan and
right.
Juneau. So not quite all the way
Yeah.
down to like British Columbia or like close to Washington like Ketchikan is, but yeah, sort of in the middle there.
Now, but is that accessible from a DIY standpoint, or is that, do
Yeah,
you need to
if
get a
you fly
boat,
in,
or?
it's got a small road system that there are road accessible streams in Sitka that you can fish. That would be a scenario where we talked about earlier, you know, getting a guide for a day and then seeing what's going on. That if I were planning a trip to Sitka, that's probably what I would do. And then Yakutat's very accessible for the DIYer. It's got camping available, variety of lodges you can stay at, and that's one, you know, you can rent a car, which rentals are limited in Yakutat, but you can get them, and
Yeah.
then drive to the
But
bridge and fish that.
both those areas are pretty much, you're going to have to fly in, and that's pretty much going to be your trip. It's not like
Exactly,
when you're
yeah.
up in the Anchorage area where you can go north or south and hit a lot of different types of areas.
Right.
Yeah. It seems like you'd be going for that one experience, I guess. But if you're going for steelhead, that would make sense, you know, to
Exactly,
go
yeah.
ahead
If
and,
you're,
yeah.
if you want Alaskan steelhead, I'd say go Yakutat or Sitka in spring. But if you want a variety of Alaskan fish plus steelhead, you're probably looking at September on the road system, prioritizing the Kenai Peninsula.
Right. Dean in Massachusetts wrote in. He says, "My wife and I have planned a vacation in Alaska from August 30th through the September 9th. Sounds like a good time.
Yeah.
We are staying in Wasilla on Carpenter Lake with access to a canoe and for the first part of our trip, and then flying to Kulik Lodge to end our vacation. Can you recommend flies I should tie for stillwater fishing while on Carpenter Lake? And spots near Wasilla that we could wet a line. Also, any general flies about trout fishing for that time of year?"
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a ton of experience on stillwater around Wasilla, but I know of a lot of people that do that. Well, I shouldn't say a lot, but some devoted people that do that, and they have nothing but good things to say about that experience. So as far as flies go, dragonfly, damselfly, nymphs, that type of thing is going to be pretty effective. Also, balanced leeches. Balanced leeches are kind of a magic bullet when it comes to stillwater fishing, at least in my experience. They can be pretty effective. And then really any black leeches, dark olive leeches. I'm a leech fan, so those are all going to be good choices. And then if you have a canoe on Carpenter Lake, that'll let you get out and cast to different spots. I've also heard that like Seymour and Beaver Lakes in that area, I think there are two lakes with beaver in them or the beaver name in them. But those lakes can be particularly productive. I would check those out.
Okay. Jason Stacy in Kentucky says, "Are camping sites easily accessible?"
Yeah, that's another way that we are very blessed in Alaska is, yeah, there are a lot of state parks, Department of Natural Remaintained campgrounds. It's like $5 if you want to park for the day or $20 to camp for the night. And they're pretty, you know, Spartan campsites, just a place to pitch the tent and a fire pit and a picnic bench. Some of them don't even have picnic benches, but they're kind of what you need if you're, you know, if you're doing your own camping setup. And thankfully, those are, yeah, pretty widespread across the state, especially on the highway system. The Parks Highway has a lot. The Richardson Highway has a lot. Yeah, no shortage of those.
What about reservations? I mean, here in Colorado, if you want to go camping in a campground, you have to get on the computer 6 months ahead of time if you're
Yeah.
trying to get a reservation, unless you want to, you know, first come, first serve, which is always dicey.
Right,
What
exactly, yeah.
do you have to do in Alaska to make sure that you're going to have a place to sleep at night?
Yeah, so a lot of the popular ones, like on the Kenai Peninsula or on the Parks Highway, Montana Creek is a really popular one. Probably best to go on and make reservations if you can, but then a lot of them, and this has been my strategy, you know, I know Montana Creek's busy, for example, so I'll go 20 miles past that to, say, Troublesome Creek campground that is not nearly as popular. and I'll just stay there. And yeah, it adds a little bit of commute time, if you will, to fishing the next day, but I have some relative peace and quiet, and I didn't have to fight for a campsite, and I'm not like pitching my tent on top of somebody. So that can be a good strategy. And again, that's where we're lucky to have relatively abundant campsites. But then the more campsites, when I say remote, I still mean on the road system. I just mean farther from, you know, like Anchorage or Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are less likely to get booked up super far in advance. So you're probably a lot safer doing a first come, first serve type of deal on those.
Yeah. And what about like BLM camping, National Forest camping, you know, kind of boondocking out there?
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. Again, just being aware of land ownership. But yeah, if it's
right.
National Forest, they're pretty good about posting regulations about that. You know, like near trailheads or parking lots, and you can find a lot of that information online.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be my biggest suggestion, is just first do your research so you make sure that you're not getting woken up in the middle of the night only to find out you can't camp here. But yeah, there are opportunities for that in the National Forest and, yeah, BLM ground as well.
Yeah, Chuck in Placerville, California, he says, what accommodations do you leverage, an RV, a van, tent camping? And I don't know, you mentioned a truck. Are you usually sleeping in your truck or what?
Usually, yeah. I try and, for me, it's all about the fishing. So if I'm going somewhere, you know, for multiple days, it's all about fishing, and I basically need something over my head to keep the rain off and enough food to keep me happy. So yeah, sometimes I'll bring a tent, sometimes not. Sometimes I'll just sleep in the bed of my truck and pull the tonneau cover over. It's a bit of a tight squeeze, but it works. But yeah, kind of going back to the accessibility question, there are thankfully quite a few camping sites and campgrounds with like RV hookups. Those are going to be a little bit fewer and far between. But they are along the road systems, like the parks and on the Kenai and the Richardson. Those are available. So, but again, if it's going to have RV hookups, it's probably also going to get booked up in advance.
Right.
So yeah, you probably want to
plan ahead. Right. Yeah. Plan ahead.
That.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Or be prepared for, you know, boondocking.
Right.
I mean, we've got friends that will not boondock. And for those that don't know what that is, it's having your RV or your camper off the grid, no electricity, no water hookups. And so you better have your water and solar and a generator and things like that. Lastly, Bill Thomas in Houston, of course, this is always a question. What bear precautions do you take?
Yeah, bears, the other animals that love salmon.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for me, it's bear spray. I do carry a .44 pistol with me. Thankfully, I've never had to use it. Knock on wood, I won't have to, but they say, and I hope never to have experience with this, but they say bear spray is more effective than a pistol, you know, if a bear is charging you. But I've always felt, and I've had, I wouldn't call them close calls with bears, but they've been close enough to where it shook me up pretty good, you know, and I always feel so puny with my little can of bear spray. The reassuring weight of a .44 revolver is pretty welcomed if you see a bear. But I feel like a lot of possible bear encounters can be curbed before they happen, you know. So, one, making sure that you're making a lot of noise. If you're in bear country, be aware of it. If you want to wear like a bear bell or a noisemaker or something, do that. Usually I'm wearing like my fly vest and my backpack with, you know, like my forceps and clippers and water bottle and net. Like it's all clanking around, so I make plenty of noise. I'm not too worried about that. But then if I'm planning on fishing somewhere that's a little bit sketchy as far as bears go, you know, I'll always try and bring a buddy with me. Traveling in groups, have backup, that sort of thing. But yeah, definitely have bear spray.
A buddy that runs slower than you, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you don't have to outrun
the
bear. You just outrun the friend.
Your buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that revolver was always hanging in the middle of our tent in Alaska. My dad had, you know, always hanging. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say I have not had to use mine, but that story I told at the beginning of the show with my friend Ryan, We did have to fire a pistol into the ground because there was a black bear that was getting a little bit too familiar with us, and thankfully that did the trick, and he ran off, and we never saw him again. So that was, I guess, a close call, but one thing with bear spray, I know it's probably going to be easier for a lot of people, especially if you're flying, to just get bear spray once you're here than to go through the hassle of flying up with firearm. But you cannot fly with bear spray, even if it's in luggage. So that's a good thing to note. You have to buy it when you get here and discard it before you fly home or give it to...
What about on the, you know, the little the float planes and stuff? Do they care?
Yeah, I think generally they allow it. Yeah. But, yeah, definitely on, like, the major airlines, don't fly with it. I forgot one time. I knew I wasn't supposed to have it, but I was flying to Juneau and had it in my check bag, and, yeah, that was a no-no. Yeah. So.
Okay. All right. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We've got to wrap this up. But stick with me, Joe. We're going to give away some prizes here. 1 year membership to Fly Fishers International, 1 year membership to Trout Unlimited, and, of course, your book, Happy Joe's book, It's Only Fishing, courtesy of Epicenter Press. So hang tight, everybody, and we'll be doing that in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of this show? Just click on the link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you don't miss out on a chance to get one of these great prizes. Now, if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information and so that we can deliver your prizes to you. The first thing we're giving away is a 1 year membership to Fly Fishers International. To learn more about Fly Fishers International, go to flyfishersinternational.org. flyfishersinternational.org. Great organization to support. And so if you don't win, join them. Looks like our winner for that is Steve Schramm. Steve Schramm in California. So congratulations, Steve. And I know you'll enjoy your membership. And now we'll give away a 1 year membership to Trout Unlimited. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org. tu.org. And another great organization to support. Our winner for that is Michael Billow in Ohio. Michael Billow in Ohio. So congratulations, Michael. And I know you, too, will enjoy your membership. And now, we'll give away a copy of Joe's book, It's Only Fishing, courtesy of Epicenter Press. And if you don't win Joe's book, you can go to his website and get a copy there. Joe, again, your website is?
josephdjacksonwriter.com.
josephdjacksonwriter.com. So
yes, sir. To
win this, you have to be the first person to answer the question that I ask and correctly. So that's important to note. The question is, Joe had mentioned a book that he has 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 copies of in his truck at all times. What's the name of that guide that he uses in Alaska to learn about the different places and understand them and know what fish are in there? What is the name of that book? And there you go, Dean. Dean Wormell, he's the one that asked the question. He's going up there with his wife to Wasilla. So I know he's going to use this book. Yeah. The Highway Angler, Gunnar Peterson. Yes, that's correct, right, Joe? That's the one?
Yep. That's the book. Yep, that's the Bible.
That's the winner. So good job with that, Dean. Good job. And Dean, so you need to send me in the same form your mailing address. I got your name. I got your email address. I need your mailing address. I'll be sending out the book to you of Joe's book, and we'll get that right out to you as soon as I get that information from you. So be sure to send that too. Yep, Phil was the next one right behind him, and Bob Younger, yeah, a lot of people getting it right. They must have all written that one down, felt that was pretty important.
Yeah.
Joe,
that's an important one. I'm glad they took notes.
Yeah, a lot of people answering that correctly coming in here, but Dean was the first one. So congratulations, Dean, and thanks for paying attention. And Joe, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your information. Sounds like you've been all over up there fishing, and it was nice to tap into your knowledge, so I appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, Roger. Like I said, it's my favorite subject, and yeah, I hope I was helpful to people that are toying with the idea of coming up or maybe already have a trip planned. Hopefully it was of some use to them. So thanks all for listening.
I'm sure it was. So thanks again. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link at the top line of the menu, and in that archive you'll find over 400 shows now. You can search by keyword salmon, silvers, coho, Alaska, whatever you want to search for. And we've done other shows on Alaska that I think you'll enjoy as well. Our next broadcast will be on May 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern time. And that show, I'll interview Mike Watt. And our show will be What Every Tropical Flats Fly Fisher Needs to Know. Mike has fished the saltwater flats of Belize, Christmas Island, Cuba, the Yucatan, and the Florida Keys. And the techniques and methods he's learned along the way are invaluable. Join us as Mike shares what he's learned about fly fishing the flats, including tackle, knots, casting, presentation, tactics, and much more. So to be sure to add this to your calendar. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.